Rader, I'm here with Judge Schall and Judge Moore. Are you prepared to begin your argument?
I am.
I'm going to have to ask you to watch your own time. As you know, you have 10 minutes in your initial argument. I'll try and remind you as you approach that point that you need to wind up your initial presentation. May I also ask you to pause occasionally in case one of the judges wishes to ask a question. We don't have you in our sight, so we need to have a chance to interrupt you if necessary. Will you be mindful of that necessity?
I will. Thank you, Judge Rader.
All right, then you may proceed, Mr. Jones.
Thank you. We submit in this case that reversal of the Court of Federal Claims is clearly required. The point issue for attorneys and associated costs is not breach of contract. It is not a claim that arises under some species of equity or that requires reliance or the like. This is a claim under the explicit terms of a statute. The Equal Access to Justice Act, and particularly subparagraph D. There are three of that law that are directly applicable and we submit controlling here. The first, section D1A, which says that the court shall award fees unless it finds the position of the government was substantially just. That means that a prevailing plaintiff, such as here, is entitled.
Excuse me one second, Mr. Jones. We're having a little trouble with you're breaking up a little bit as you talk. Are you still there?
Yes, I am. And you're not lying.
Can you hear us?
I can, quite clearly.
Okay, well maybe if you can proceed, but we're having a little trouble hearing you here, so don't stand too close to the microphone, but go ahead and proceed.
I'll do my best. I was discussing Section D.A. Of the Act, of the statute that controls this matter, and that provides that a prevailing plaintiff, such as High Shear, shall receive his attorney's fees unless the government establishes what amounts to an affirmative defense of substantial justification. The second provision of that statute that's pertinent here is sub D to D, which we've cited here, provides.
Mr. Jones, once again, I need to interrupt you. Are you speaking into a speakerphone or into a telephone?
I'm speaking into a telephone.
Okay. We're still having a little trouble with it breaking up. Let's go ahead and proceed again, Mr. Jones. We'll make sure you receive a little extra time for these interruptions.
I will try to speak slowly and as distinctly as I can. Thank you, Your Honor. The section of the controlling statute to which we just alluded provide that the position of the United States, which is to be evaluated for substantial justification, include the action of the agency.
But counsel, this is Judge Moore. But doesn't the court below find in its opinion that the defendant's positions during the development of the case and the litigation had reasonable foundations and were substantially justified?
Those words appear in the decision, Judge Moore. They appear in the same paragraph in which the statement made that the court finds that the defendant's position during the development of the case and this in a case with withdrawn. In that instance, that case referred to the matter before the court complaint. And the intent of that paragraph reads in the defense the government presented were reasonable and substantial justice. That referred to defense that were presented in the case to the court. Those are defense. Those are not the actions or the statements of the that made the final decision. On the condition that that here in section B1B says whether or not this United States was justified shall be determined on the basis of the record, including record with respect to the act or act by the upon the civil act in a price here the Contract Act. That refer to the final decision of the contracting office. I would add that the Disputes Act itself requires that final decision to include a statement of the reason for the decision. That from 41 U.S.C. section 605. So that the Mr. action...
Mr. Jones, we're going to need to suspend. Do you have another number you can be called on? This number is not working. We're having real trouble hearing you. And unless you have another number, we're not having any success here at all.
The number that was done is our master number. We have three other lines, and you might try redialing in on one of those.
Give one of those to Reginald, who will call you back, and we'll try another number.
Okay, try 83894.
You didn't get the number?
Did you get the number?
No.
Ask him again. Just pick it up.
Mr. Jones, I'm sorry. Can you give me that phone number again, please?
It's 833-8894.
Thank you.
Reggie, I think it could be the gain on our amplifier clipping his thing, because it's turned up very loudly. If the judges wouldn't mind, if we turn it down a little, we might actually get him.
this is Peter Jones.
Mr. Jones, this is the Federal Circuit. Can you hear me now?
I can.
Okay, Mr. Jones, we're going to try again. We'll allow you to... Why don't we allow Judge Moore to ask her question again, and we'll proceed from that point.
All right.
So, counsel, my question was, doesn't the court below explicitly indicate that it considered the development of the case and the litigation behavior in its conclusion?
The sentence that you quoted appeared in the decision. It appeared in a paragraph that begins, in sum, the defenses the government presented were reasonable and therefore substantially justified under the statute. In that context, the statement about defense position during the development of the case is clearly a reference to what in the case that in the matter for the Court of Federal Claims after file suit. There is no indication in this paragraph, or I would say in the decision, that the court considered those final decisions as part of the position of the government. Hello?
Yes, we're still with you, Mr. Jones. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I wasn't getting an echo anymore, and I thought perhaps I'd lost you.
Nope, we're hearing you better now. Please proceed.
The law that to which I've just alluded is very clear that the CFC was required to consider the contracting officer's final decisions and their falsity as part of the position of the United States.
Mr. Jones?
And in the language that I just quoted.
Mr. Jones?
Yes?
I was going to blow the whistle. Mr. Jones, this is Judge Schall on the court.
Yes.
You said that the falsity of the decision, that suggests some intentional misstatement, if you will, and put it in crude terms, a knowing misstatement of the facts. It does appear here that you elicited on cross-examination at the trial proceedings that, yes, there was a mistake as to the reason for the shortfall, but you're not suggesting, are you, that there was any improper conduct?
I'm not suggesting, and I don't think that the record would support the notion that there was deliberate deception in this case.
So really what we have here is a situation where the contracting officer, through I guess the woman who prepared the decision, was mistaken as to the reasons for the shortfall, right?
There was the special to prepare the decision was a man, and that statement that he made as to both two particulars: first, that there was a significant reduction in their budget, and secondly, that budget had anything to do with the amount of goods that they ordered.
Well, let me
was
let me,
incorrect.
Excuse
However,
me,
let me
Mr.
Say
Jones.
This.
Let me ask you this, and believe me, I'm not trying to denigrate your argument, but It was established that the contracting officer's decision was mistaken in this regard, there's a footnote in the EJA decision that recognizes this. So I guess I'm having a difficult time understanding what the problem is here.
Well, first, Your Honor, I don't agree that footnote acknowledges the falsity here. And in fact, I think that footnote is quite misleading. It fails to acknowledge that the fundamental testimony of that person who wrote that language was that what was stated to be a fact was not a fact.
Yeah, there was a mistake made.
And in answer to the question you previously raised, you said, does this rise to the level of some kind of false? I think that, for example, if you would apply the standards of false statements or the False Claims Act, that this statement, if deliberately false, was made regardless of whether or not it was true. Because the funding of the agency was readily ascertainable. And simply to come out and say, well, it was substantially reduced.
But counsel, didn't the court find that the actions of the government were negligent, but expressly find there was no bad faith on the part of the government?
Yes, the CFA said that.
And also, on page 3 of the opinion, doesn't the court hold that the government's position, viewed over the entire course of the dispute, was not substantially justified, is the issue to be decided by the court?
Yes, that's the court's statement of the law.
Right, so whether the government's position over the entire course of the dispute, and you want us to find that the government, that the court, since it didn't articulate in detail the fact that the negligent behavior by the contracting officer, since they didn't speak to that in the discussion of the denial of attorney's fees, you want us to assume that they didn't consider it, even though they told us at the outset that they know they had to?
No, I don't think that's a fair statement, Judge Moore. I think that our position is the CFC, the Court of Federal Claims, should be taken at its word when, in its conclusion, it said, in sum, the defenses that the government presented. The statements in the final decision were not part of those defenses, but they are, by law, part of the position of the government for purposes of determining substantial justification. And we further argue, and I'll submit this, when a final decision that's required by law to state faith contains a false state of material fact, and by false, I mean you're just untrue, particularly where that fact is within the government's purview, it's easy to find in the government record, and it should certainly be accurate as part of the determination to be made by a contracting officer, that A has to be considered, for where? In other words, considered for what it is. And first, we submit that something like that really has to be given very substantial weight in determining whether the position of the government was substantially justified. Indeed, we would argue that where something like this occurred, there should be a first day rule that the position of the government, when it states in the final decision, requires the contractor to litigate, is false. that the position of government is not standard justified, period.
Mr. Jones, let's at this point hear from Mr. Austin for the government, and then we'll restore to you your full 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Mr. Austin. If you have any trouble hearing Mr. Jones, will you please let us know?
I will. Thank you.
Please proceed, Mr. Austin.
May it please the court, Hyshear's argument takes one sentence in the judge's comprehensive opinion regarding the government's position as being substantially justified, takes one sentence and attempts to expand it to the level that it demands relief, in the words of Hyshear. But when we read the trial court's opinion and understand that, one, the standard of review is an abuse of discretion, Hyshear has not pointed to anything that was in the opinion or that the trial court failed to do that would render the trial court's finding that the government's position was substantially justified that would render it wrong. Taking Hyshear's argument at face value, where it says that because of the wrong information in the contracting officer's final decision, it was forced to litigate and to discover the true facts, implicit in that statement is once he discovered the true facts, why did he end the litigation? During discovery and prior to trial, we acknowledged that there were reasons other than the funding which led to the variance between the estimated and actual orders. If his purpose was to find the true facts, once he found the true facts, the litigation should have ended. He continued to pursue, or Hyshear continued to pursue, the litigation in its quest for lost profits and lost profits through all of the years of the contract to include the base year and the option year. If we look at the contracting...
You're saying that the issue here was not so much that there was an error with respect to the estimates, but rather the real focus of the proceedings was damages. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. From almost the beginning of the litigation, we acknowledged that there was information that was omitted from the formula that the government used to make DeBasic's estimate. Our position during the litigation was that the omitted data had little of no effect upon the orders that were actually ordered versus the estimate. As the trial court stated...
That's certainly your position. I understand you to be making during litigation, but as I understood the appellant's argument, it was focused on what he perceived to be the trial court's failure to take into account the negligence in the contracting officer's decision as part of the EAJA analysis. And I understand that he is basically saying that failure to take into account that information in this analysis is a violates the law with regard to how you determine the EAJA entitlement.
Your Honor, I understand his position. And because he waited until, in essence, his reply to make the argument that the Wilner line of cases does not apply, we didn't have an opportunity to address that. But when you look at what he is arguing, to draw an analogy, it's similar to the grounds for a termination default. I believe the law in this circuit says that so long as there are other grounds that existed at the time, then the termination for default will be upheld. When we look at the variance between the estimated and the actual orders, there was one reason that was posited in the contracting officer's final decision, that of a lack of funding. But when we got to trial, we identified at least three other reasons that predated the government the litigation that explained the variance between the estimated and the actual orders.
But I think that their argument is that you wouldn't have ended up in litigation if the contracting officer has done his job properly, and therefore Highshear was forced to bring suit and respond to the contracting officer's only articulated basis for denial, which was ultimately determined to be negligent on the part of the government.
I understand that, Your Honor, but I once again...
Why shouldn't they get some attorney's fees, maybe proportioned for that purpose?
Your Honor, because if we, accepting their argument where we are to focus on the contracting officer's final decision, as with any document, we have to read the document as a whole. When you look at the one sentence that Highshear has identified as worthy of some relief, it is in the portion where he's explaining the underlying rationale. But then the contracting officer goes on to say, based upon the following, and then he lists three reasons, and that's the same document, I believe, is at appendix page 21 and 15, but he goes on to list three reasons why he denies the claim for damages. Among them is that the executive summary included with the IFB and contract specifically stated that the contract would not have any guaranteed minimum order quantities. And then he goes on to say that if I had determined that Highshear Technology is entitled to damage, I believe that the amount to which it would be entitled to would be the amount of actual damage which it suffered as a result of the shortfall between the estimated and ordered quantities for the three ordering years. That is the standard that the trial court used for damages. So even if we accept his argument, that only explains one step in the equation in terms of liability plus damages. The government was correct in terms of, when I say correct, Your Honor, we were substantially justified in, the government was substantially justified in pursuing this through the litigation because the government's position, both pre-litigation and during the litigation, was that the omitted data had little effect on the actual orders, and therefore Highshear was not entitled to damages, especially when we look at some other facts that the trial court alluded to in her opinion on substantial justification. Highshear bid the same price for each of the five ordering years. If they were relying on the government's estimate, they should have varied their cost. We had, the government had a defense contract audit agency review of Highshear's claim. The auditor found that Highshear would have lost money if the contract had, if all the orders had been fulfilled. And it was that, then the president of Highshear agreed with that at trial. So when we look at everything in balance, when we look at the totality of the circumstances, we have what was amounts to a negligent statement, an incorrect statement on Highshear's side of the ledger. But then when we look at the government's position for litigating this case as far as we have at least three other reasons that the trial court identified as to the variance. And we agreed, we admitted that there was a problem with the formula. It was the amount of damages and the effect where, that we were substantially justified. When we look at the amount of recovery that Highshear received, when we look at the facts that there was a general reduction in armed forces, which could not have been foreseen at the time that the estimates were done. There was a change in Army policy encouraging the return of unserviceable parts, which was not foreseen at the time. And lastly, there was a return of residual assets from the system manager and the contract. All of these predated the litigation. They were part of the government's position. So when we look at the totality of the circumstance, which the trial court did, she admitted that there were four reasons that were posited through the litigation. One of those would suggest that the government was incorrect, but the other three shows that the government's position was substantially justified. That is the crux of the issue, Your Honor.
Counsel, does it show your position was substantially justified or that the damages were de minimis?
Both, Your Honor. In terms of the standard is that the government does not have to be 100% correct in every step of the formulation. I think the standard is, would it, a reasonable person be justified in doing what the government did? And when we look at, yes, it's not the sole determinant is the lack of damages is not the sole determinant. But when we look, would a reasonable person have litigated this case as the government had given the outcome? And that is the substantial justification that the trial court employed. And when we look at substantial justification in that light, then their argument that they take one sentence out of the contracting officer's final decision, one sentence out of the trial court's, and balloon it into something that is worthy of monetary relief, when we have all of these other factors indicating substantial justification, their argument makes little sense in the main.
Thank you, Mr. Austin. Anything further?
Subject to any further questions, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Austin. Mr. Jones, you have 5 minutes.
First, I should be clear that our complaint, our case here, is not that the contracting officer was negligent. Our case here is that the position of the government, that the Court of Federal Claims was required to evaluate, must have included the final decision. The operative statement of fact in that final decision, the reason why entitlement is denied, is a statement that the agency's funding was reduced, and that that's what accounted for the difference between the original estimate and the order. That statement is not true. It was never true. And its untruth was ascertainable within the agency, readily ascertainable. If that is considered as part of the position of the agency, it has to taint everything that follows. Contractors and their legal advisors.
Counsel.
Yes.
This is Judge Moore. If the government, lower court's opinion had expressly said something along the lines of, in sum, the defenses of the government were reasonable and substantially justified, even though the contracting officer decision was not. Overall, therefore, we conclude in our discretion that we are not going to award attorney's fees, even though we've clearly considered all of this. If there was no doubt that the trial court had clearly considered the negligence and the wrong decision of the contracting officer, but nonetheless said at its discretion, based on the government's conduct at litigation, for example, they didn't continue to defend that position and those sorts of things, would you be here today arguing that that was an abuse of discretion, or is your argument really focused on the absence of evidence that the trial court considered that?
Well, at this point in time, our principal argument and the issue we have presented is based on what the trial court said was its basis for decision, that it was based on what it had determined to be the reasonableness of the government's defense, which are their positions in litigation. By the answer hypothetically, had the court said yes, we looked at the acknowledged what we acknowledge to be the untrue statement, the untrue operative statement of the final decision, and we find that somehow excused or submerged or diluted by subsequent reasonableness of the government's position. I think we'd probably still be here because, as I said previously, we believe that there should be a per se rule here. Contractors and their legal advisors generally believe that government contracting personnel act in good faith and are truthful. A decision like this could well mislead a contractor into abandoning a valid claim. And
Mr. Jones?
Yes.
Excuse me, this is Judge Chalian. What if there had been no contracting officer's decision at all?
Then, in that case, I don't really know what the position of the government at the agency level would be. I suppose you would be left with the proposition that their own position is the breach that they committed, which the Court of Federal Claims found, and your court affirmed. I think that there can be no justification, substantial or otherwise, for a breach of contract. In the Hubbard case, where...
But there is law, excuse me again, there is law, though, to the effect that the EJIA law is not an automatic fee-shifting statute. And I guess the point is that you don't have to have a contracting officer's decision. You can have a claim submitted, the contracting officer does not issue a decision within 60 days, I guess, and then the contractor has the right to come into court or go before the Board of Contract Appeals. And the question is, you know, was the decision of the contracting officer denying the claim either in a decision or de facto correct or incorrect?
Well, I think what you're saying there is if there's a deemed denial by failure to dissolve, I think then, Your Honor, the substantive issue for the trust form is simply is the contract claim justified or correct? But in this case, we have a decision. In addition, by the way, if there's a deemed denial under the rules of the AFBCA, the contractor can file a motion to require that a decision be issued. But a decision is required by statute, and it's required to state its reason. And in this case, we have one. And the operative reason is false. And it must be. It must be, for purposes of EJIA, the position of the government at the agency level. What else is there?
Thank you. Mr. Jones, do you have any final comments? Your time is about expired.
That concludes my comment. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Thank you, Mr. Austin. That concludes our hearing.
All rise.